Thank you to Bob Hughes, Open University to the Left, for inviting me to talk about this topic of the Constitution and its disabling impact on American politics today. Also, thanks to David Barsamian, because he sort of bugged me and encouraged me to do an audio version of my writings about issues with the Constitution. We do live in an insane, absurd historical moment, if you don't mind me saying so. Inequality so extreme now that three absurdly rich people possess as much wealth between them as the bottom half of the population in the U.S. Economic power so concentrated that you can count on one hand the multi-trillion dollar financial institutions that control the nation's economic and political assets. Six corporations together own more than half U.S. print electronic media. Three internet giants, Google, Facebook, Amazon, rule online communications and shopping. The presidency held by a malignant, narcissist, creeping fascist, pseudo-billionaire most of the nation hates. He pretends to be a populist while doing everything he can to distribute wealth, power further upward. We have been hearing constantly for 2+ years that Russia undermined our so-called democracy, but majority public opinion has been essentially irrelevant in the American oligarchy for decades. In his response to Donald Trump's State of the Union address, Bernie Sanders cited one poll after another showing that most Americans support progressive social democratic things like single-payer health insurance, free college tuition, workers' rights to organize, collectively bargain, a doubling of the minimum wage, progressive taxation, green jobs programs to give people decent employment while helping, by the way, save the planet. Bernie could have added that most U.S. millennials and now most Democrats tell pollsters that they prefer socialism to capitalism. Imagine that. Great. So what? Who cares? In the United States, a recent authoritative political science text reports, quote, government policy reflects the wishes of those with money, not the wishes of millions of ordinary citizens who turn out every 2 years to choose among the pre-approved, money-vetted candidates for federal office. In 2019, as in 2015, Sanders is the only remotely viable presidential candidate actually running in accord with majority public opinion, but the notion of him getting a major party presidential nomination is in all likelihood, again, a pipe dream. The Democratic Party isn't about social and economic justice, democracy, or ecological survival. It isn't even mainly about winning elections. It's about serving and colluding with corporate sponsors and climbing the neoliberal capitalist oligarchy. Think Bill NAFTA Clinton, the multimillionaire head of the Clinton Foundation. Think Barack, Trans-Pacific Partnership Obama, who has entered the economic oligarchy now as a reward for his dutiful service to the nation's unelected dictatorship of capital. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The dismal, dollar-drenched Democrats prefer losing to the right, even a creeping fascist white nationalist right, over losing to the left, even the explicitly non-radical social democratic left in their own party. Forget the politicians, George Carlin used to say. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't, Carlin said. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything, Carlin said. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets, and they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and the information you get to hear. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want, more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you, George Carlin continued, what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around a kitchen table and think about how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 f***ing years ago. It's called the American Dream, George Carlin said, because you have to be asleep to believe it. In the nation's reigning dollar-drenched party and election system, as in its legal system, as in its media system, as in its educational systems, including its college entrance systems, as we were recently reminded, money talks and bullshit walks. Now I'll say something really scandalous. If you put on your historical earbud and listen hard through the ages, you just might hear the United States' big, wealthy, powdered wig-wearing, merchant capitalist and slave-owning founding fathers laughing about this big, messy state of class rule that we are in. I'm always amused when I hear some political talking head denounce some modern-day plutocratic outrage as contrary to the noble and democratic intent of our holy founding fathers. David Barsamian likes to call them the founding finaglers. It's total nonsense. People need to do their damn history. Democracy, the rule of the majority, was the last thing the nation's aristo-republican founders wanted to see break out in their infant republic. Drawn from the elite property segments in the new nation, most of the delegates to the 1787 Constitutional Convention shared their compatriot John Jay's view that those, quote, who owned the country ought to govern it. As celebrated U.S. historian Richard Hofstadter noted in his classic 1948 text, the first serious history book I ever read, The American Political Tradition and the Men Who Made It, in their minds, Hofstadter wrote, liberty was linked not to democracy, but to property. Democracy was a profoundly dangerous concept to the framers, to the nation's young nation's architect. Democracy meant, and here I'm quoting Hofstadter, unchecked rule by the masses. It was certain, in Hofstadter's word, to, quote, bring arbitrary redistribution of property, destroying the very essence of liberty. Liberty was about property, not democracy, to the founders. As constitutional historian Jennifer Nadelsky notes, protection of property, meaning the people who own large amounts of it, was the main object of government for all but one of the United States Constitution's framers, Lonely James Wilson. The non-affluent majority was for the founders what Nadelsky calls a problem to be contained. We the people were a problem to be contained in the view of the founding fathers. And anyone who doubts that and doubts the militantly anti-democratic character of the founders, character of the founders' worldview, all they got to do is go read, if you think I'm lying, all you got to do is go read the Federalist Papers, written by the leading advocates of the U.S. Constitution to garner support for their preferred, more centralized form of national government to surpass the Articles of Confederation in 1787 and 1788. In Federalist No. 10, Holy Founder James Madison argued that democracies were, quote, spectacles of turbulence, incompatible with the rights of property. Democratic governments gave rise, Madison wrote, to factious leaders who could kindle a flame among dangerous masses for wicked projects like the abolition of debts and, horrors of horrors, a more equal division of property. Okay? This isn't, you know, Michael Parenti or some radical Marxist in the 20th century writing about those horrible, terrible founders. This is the founders themselves in language that can be found in the Federalist Papers. Extend the geographic sphere of the U.S. Republic, Madison wrote, and it will joyfully become more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and act in union with each other. A big republic would be good because it would spread people out further and make it less likely that they would actually be able to unite and fight collectively for their class interests from the bottom up. At the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Madison called for an upper U.S. Legislative Assembly, an American House of Lords, comprised of elite property holders, which is, of course, the U.S. Senate. The Senate, he hoped, would checkmate a coming rise in the proportion of Americans who will labor, Madison wrote, under all the hardships of life, and who will secretly sigh, Madison wrote, for a more equal distribution of its blessings, of life's blessings. In other words, that they'll call for a more equal, egalitarian distribution of property and wealth. Madison worried that the propertyless and property poor American majority might in time, quote, outnumber those who are placed above them. According to the equal laws of suffrage, Madison warned, the power will slide into the hands of the non-affluent. And what a disaster that would be. What a disaster democracy would be. What a disaster it would be if the propertyless and property poor majority actually ruled, if we had popular governance. My favorite Federalist paper, though, is number 35 by Alexander Hamilton, the future first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton argued that the common people found their proper representatives among the small class of wealthy merchant capitalists. The idea of an actual representation of all classes of people by persons of each class, Hamilton wrote, is altogether visionary. The weight and superior acquirements of the merchants render them more equal than the other classes, wrote Hamilton. Their superior weight and vision render them more equal than the propertyless majority. Somebody please tell Broadway's Lin-Manuel Miranda about the language in Federalist Number 35. Alexander Hamilton was not only not Puerto Rican and not black, he was white. Not only that, he was a militantly anti-democratic classist. The New England clergyman Jeremy Belknap captured the fundamental idea behind the U.S. founders' notion of what they like to call popular government. Let it stand as a principle, Belknap wrote to an associate in the late 1780s as they were deliberating on the Constitution. Let it stand as a principle that government originates from the people, but let the people be taught that they are unable to govern themselves. The sovereignty of government emanates from you. You, however, are unable to govern yourselves. But, of course, it wasn't just about teaching the people that they were incapable of self-rule. Their Holy Constitution was designed to make sure that the popular majority couldn't govern itself, even if it thought it could. Even if it got the crazy, wacky, Looney Tunes, wild, radical Marxist idea in its head that it could govern itself. The Constitution was structured in such a way as to make damn sure that they couldn't actually do it. And so the rich white fathers, our holy founders, crafted a form of government that was a monument to popular incapacitation, with the explicit stated purpose of keeping the majority and the specter of democracy at bay. Constitution divided the federal government into three parts, with just one half of one of those three parts, the House of Representatives, elected directly by the people, a category that, of course, at the time excluded blacks, women, Native Americans, and propertyless white males. In other words, it excluded most of the human beings living in the early republic. The Constitution set up elaborate checks and balances to prevent the possibility of the laboring multitude influencing policy. It introduced a system of rigidly fixed, steeply time-staggered elections, 2 years for the House, 6 years for the Senate, 4 years for the presidency, precisely to discourage sweeping all at once popular electoral rebellions. That's explicitly the purpose, to prevent that from happening in the discussions in the Constitutional Convention. They created a Supreme Court appointed for life by the president, with confirmation restricted to the upper chamber of propertied elites. And the High Court was granted veto power over legislation or executive actions that might too strongly bear the imprint of the wretched multitude, the propertyless and property poor rabble who might secretly sigh for the more egalitarian distribution of wealth. The Constitution's curious and bizarre, and if you're from the United States, it's always fun to try to explain the Electoral College to people from other countries. And they're like, huh? The Constitution's curious Electoral College, I always say that flunked the democracy entrance exam. The Constitution's curious Electoral College innovation guaranteed that the popular majority would not directly select the U.S. president, even on the limited basis of one vote for each propertied white male at the time. And of course, as we all so painfully know, the Electoral College is still in effect. You know, they were very excited about the checks and balances they had between the different branches of government. You know, the founders fantasized that they had crafted a form of governance in which parties would never emerge. They believed that there would never be any parties. And of course, the funny things about it is that the nation's first parties it formed precisely around the debate over the Constitution and then funding and assumption and other things in the 1790s. Checks and balances between the different branches don't mean very much when one party controls all or most of the branches, as has occurred repeatedly in American history, and as still sort of goes on, except for one half of the Congress, that is the House of Representatives right now. Now, it's true that the Constitution's Article 5 provides a mechanism technically permitting we the people to alter the nation's charter, but the process for amending the U.S. Constitution was and remains exceedingly difficult, short of revolution and or civil war. As a progressive constitution critic Daniel Lazare has observed, moments after establishing the people as the omnipotent makers and breakers of constitutions, the Constitution announced that changing so much as a comma of the Constitution would require the approval of 2/3 of each House of Congress plus 3/4 of the state. The people did not assert their sovereignty in 1787, rather the founders invoked it. Once they uttered the magic incantation, they hastened to put the genie back in the bottle by declaring the people all but powerless to alter their own government. Now, you know, progressives have long advocated constitutional amendments to more properly align our politics and our policy with public opinion, but Article 5 is typically just too steep a barrier, and that's on purpose. Under its rule today, 13 of the nation's 50 states can disallow constitutional changes while containing just 4% of the nation's population. You can stop a constitutional amendment with 13 states, and you can go find 13 states that have 4% of the whole population. So states containing 1 in 25 Americans altogether can veto a constitutional amendment. It took the secession and military defeat of the slave South between 1861 and 1865 to pass amendments abolishing slavery and granting citizenship and suffrage to black human beings in the U.S. South. And of course, much of that was subsequently rolled back into sort of a de facto form of slavery, and disenfranchisement was instituted in the late 19th century in the Jim Crow era. Now, the Constitution is no small part of how a majority progressive nation, I mean, it's one of the stunning things about us. If you look at the public opinion data, the surveys on policy, the majority of the country is like Bernie Sanders social Democrats, a kind of left-center progressive. The Constitution's part of how such a country that votes primarily with not so much enthusiasm, but primarily for centrist Democrats is ruled by arch-reactionary white nationalist Republicans. So what if the GOP is viewed unfavorably by 60% of the U.S. population? The Electoral College renders the overall popular presidential vote largely irrelevant. It gives each state an extra vote for both senators that they send to Washington, no matter how small their populations are. The Electoral College triples the clout of the nation's 8 smallest states and doubles that of the next 6 smallest states relative to their populations. For the 5th time in history and the 2nd in this century, 2 years ago, the democracy-flunking Electoral College installed a president who failed to win the popular vote. In Trump's case, by 3 million votes. That's the biggest all-time popular vote-losing president of all time, and I'm not trying to express any particular sympathy for Hillary Clinton because she knew the rules of the game going in. You know, this is the Electoral College rules are pretty clear. Fenway Park is a goofy ballpark, but if you can hit a ball, it would be a home run in Wrigley Field, and it's going to bounce off the big green monster in Fenway and could be a single. And she didn't play the game the right way. Okay, so I'm not feeling sorry for her, but anyway, Trump's in there, and he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. The creeping fascist Donald Trump made it into the world's most powerful job, thanks in part to the Electoral College, which renders presidential campaigning irrelevant and close to non-existent in most of the nation. If most of you are longtime, full-time Illinoisians, and unlike me, have never lived in a contested state, I have. I've lived years in Iowa. Most of my life, I've lived in uncontested states. Uncontested states, you don't know what a presidential election is. You really don't. You might have an idea of it from TV. But we're down to about, what, 12 states now, 15 states that actually have a presidential election. But thanks to the Electoral College, why bother? Illinois is blue in advance, which means all the electors are going blue. Why really bother with the Deep South? They're already red in advance, which means all the electors there are going on the Republican side. It's only places like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio. Now there's some of these purplish states. Some states, you know, it's like they don't know whether they're contested or not. Some more might be contested this time. They might get a presidential election. And the Electoral College system just gives this absurdly outsized weight to disproportionately white and right-leaning rural states. And of course, it just openly violates the core democratic principles of majority rule and one person, one vote. Now, when I agreed a while back to come back and do this topic on this date, I thought, well, that'll be fun because I want to talk about this, but it's going to be, I like to work off the news cycle. It's going to be completely off the news cycle, you know? And then actually, this last couple weeks, the Democratic presidential candidates have started bitching about the Electoral College, interestingly enough. And so it's not completely outside of the news cycle. And it's been fascinating to watch cable news and see right-wing Republican experts come up, because that's what you do in cable news. You get the Democrat over here and the Republican over there, and that's the whole spectrum, the right and the left. And to actually see the right-wing Republican guys actually get up there and just say flat out, we're not a democracy, and the founders didn't want us to be, and we shouldn't be. And the funny thing about it is that the line from Trump and the Republicans is that thanks to the Electoral College, there's an election in the whole country. That's what they say. They go, the small states would be completely, you know, ignored, and we'd only focus on the big cities. And it's just complete nonsense. It's the exact opposite. They're saying 2 + 2 = 5 there. Because of the Electoral College and its winner-take-all electoral system and the partisan geographic polarization of the states now, where you can just write them off, we actually have a presidential election in 15 states at most. The Senate, I love the Senate apportionment system. It's even more skewed to the right. The 2% of Americans, and I'm talking about this, every state gets 2 senators no matter what population they have, which to me is just, it's just Monty Python-esque, you know? It's darkly humorous. The 2% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 smallest states have the same amount of senatorial representation as the 51% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 largest states. Red Wyoming, I love this, home to 573,720 people, holds U.S. senatorial parity with Blue California, where more than 39 American millions reside. That's 1 senator for every 19.5 million Californians versus 1 senator for every 278,000 Wyomingians. What's a Wyomingian? I don't know. Let's say a Wyoming resident. A Wyomingian. Talk about a rotten borough system. You know, they still have rotten boroughs in the British House of Lords. Speaking of boroughs, just one of New York City's 5 boroughs, Brooklyn, slated to be home of the Left Forum this year, has 2.6 million people. If Brooklyn, one of New York City's 5 boroughs, were a state and U.S. senators were apportioned there at the same population to senator ratio as Wyoming, Brooklyn would have 9 U.S. senators. And I'm thinking in Brooklyn, it's unlikely that a single one of them would be a Republican. Now the same goes for Chicago. which is home to 2.7 million people. You know, Brooklyn and Chicago are like the same size. The Chicago metropolitan area is 9.5 million people. If it enjoyed Wyoming's population to senator ratio, Chicagoland would have 17 U.S. senators. I mean, think about that. That'd be like one person, one vote, right? Which is like one of the core elementary baseline definitions of democracy is one person, one vote. I'll get even crazier here. The following 13 states have a combined population of 34.4 million. Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and good old Wyoming. Together, these 13 red states send 26 Republicans to the U.S. Senate. Now, granted, those numbers are before the last midterm elections. I did crunch those numbers before that. There might be I might be one off. I doubt it, though. The single state of California with a population more than 5 million higher than those 13 states combined, of course, sends two Democratic senators to our House of Lords, the U.S. Senate. This proportionate system, this apportionment system means that the Republican Senate majority answers to a very disproportionately white, rural, and reactionary section of the electorate, and due to a population shift from the agricultural interior to crowded corridors along the coast, it is now at least mathematically possible to cobble together a Senate majority with states that account for just 17.6% of the popular vote. I mean, that's just insane from a Democratic perspective. It's not insane from a right-wing oligarchic perspective. And, you know, don't think that Donald Trump isn't getting a significant part of his agenda through. Not all of it, but one of the more neglected ones that, you know, everything's been Russia now for so long that we forget about all the other shit that's going on. And the handing over of the federal bench and the staffing of the federal judiciary, not to mention the Supreme Court, by the right-wing Federalist Society is a legacy that's going to be with us for a very long time. And who is in charge of appointing of passing judgment on Supreme Court appointments? Just the U.S. Senate, not the House. And that U.S. Senate is absurdly overrepresentative of the red state, white nationalist, Republican, rural heartland. Now, in some nations operating with parliamentary systems, terrible, awful, disgusting, revolting, narcissistic, dysfunctional, proto-fascistic presidents or prime ministers can be compelled by votes of no confidence and the like to call or accede to new national elections. Wouldn't that be something? A vote of no confidence. We have no confidence in this malignant fascist creep. Let's have new elections, right? Such an action is unthinkable in the United States. The Holy Founders, the Holy Constitution, says that qualified voters get to select presidents, well, indirectly, we don't even directly elect presidents, once every 4 years. We can select U.S. senators once every 6 years and House representatives once every 2 years, and that's the way it is, and if you don't like it, sit down and shut up. Simon says. I once realized that I might be living in an authoritarian society when I was about 5 years old and I first played the game, Simon says, right? It's the stupidest game ever invented. Yeah. A kid says, step over the line, and you step over the line and go, no, you shouldn't have done that. Simon, I'm supposed to say Simon Says first. Oh, okay. Simon Says, put your finger in your nose. Oh, good, very good, you did it. I mean, what is that? You know? That's kind of how we are with the Constitution. I remember once I was sitting in a coffee shop in Iowa City and two University of Iowa law students were looking up for their law books and they had just read some Supreme Court decision. And the one looked at the other and said, you know, we've made like gods out of these guys wearing powdered wigs in the late 18th century, you know, when the Bourbons sat atop France. They're like holy lords or something like that. As Simon Says. As George W. Bush's White House spokesperson Dana Perino explained in March of 2008, when a journalist asked her if the citizenry should have input on U.S. foreign policy, you know, like every day, like between elections, Dana Perino said, well, you had your input. The American people have input every 4 years. And that's the way our system is set up. And, you know, Cheney said something like that too, you know? I'm not driven by polls. I don't care what people think. We were elected. Well, but Perino and Cheney were on strong constitutional ground, pathetically enough. Constitutional Simon says you get to select a president indirectly in a voting booth for 2 minutes or so once every 1,400 days. Well, except you don't actually vote for the president. The Electoral College does, and it's already a done deal in all but 12 to 15 of the states before you walk in the voting booth, but you get the idea. You get to vote for a U.S. House member. Usually, by the way, and I didn't have time to go into gerrymandering, which isn't in the Constitution. There's nothing that mandates gerrymandering in the U.S. Constitution. But you get to vote for a U.S. House member, usually in a heavily gerrymandered district for a few minutes, once every 730 days. You get to vote for each of your U.S. senators once every 1,095 days. You don't vote for Supreme Court justices. The president, for whom you don't vote directly, appoints them. Subject to approval from the Senate, which absurdly overrepresents the rural and white populace. That's how you get a serial abuser like Brett Kavanaugh in the White House. Excuse me, on the Supreme Court for life. Supremes are appointed for life, which is like a really, really long time. Well, it can be. It's why we're so desperate to, you know, everything to people, the liberals, and I mean, even me, to anything. If we just keep Ruth Bader Ginsburg alive long enough to not have a fascist president to replace her. Now, it's true that malignant presidents like Trump can be constitutionally impeached by the House and removed by the Senate, but the barriers to removal are very steep, and again, that's on purpose. It's never happened, though. Richard Nixon would certainly have been impeached and removed had he not resigned. He resigned after the moment when Senator Barry Goldwater went in and told him, we've got the votes in the Senate. So, I mean, you know, in effect, Nixon was a de facto impeachment and removal. But the barriers are very, very steep. It's never actually happened except kind of for Nixon. Full defenestration of a president, no matter how awful that president are, requires a two-thirds vote in the absurdly unrepresentative Senate. And, of course, the Senate right now is under the Republicans. It seems, as of yesterday, that the Mueller report will not contain enough juice to break through that logjam with regard to Trump. The orange fascist mother of all assholes is probably going to have to be voted out of office. And it's not clear, also, by the way, that he will accept the legitimacy of an electoral college vote that doesn't go his way in 2020. That sounds like a shocking, amazing thing to say, but there's distinct possibility that Trump is going to declare a vote that doesn't go his way illegitimate. He's been setting us up for that from the beginning of his presidency by claiming that Hillary Clinton's 3 million vote ahead of him was based on fraud, illegal immigrant. It's a complete hoax, illegal immigrant voting. But what would impeachment and removal give us under the revered, holy U.S. Constitution anyway? The presidency of the arch right-wing Republican Mike Pence. You think Trump is scary? Pence is a Christian white nationalist fascist under whose rule the hard right agenda that most of the populace hates might be advanced more effectively than it is under Trump. Don't like it? Too bad. The Constitution says. That's how it is. So, suck it up, buttercup. Get back in shape for the next strictly timeline, time-staggered, constitutionally mandated, quadrennial, candidate-centered electoral extravaganza to vote a Democrat into the White House? Really? Why bother? The Democrats are every bit as corporatized and sold out to the financial plutocracy and its military empire, to the capitalist system that emerged out of national development under the rule of the propertied elite that the holy founders worked so hard to protect. Every bit is captive to and sold out to and owned by that system as the Republicans. And they are that way, thanks in part to the outrageously outsized role of big money campaign contributions in the nation's politics, in its ever more absurdly expensive elections. And that role of money, the role of campaign finance, the role of the wealth primary, so to speak, in our electoral process, is traceable at least in part to the U.S. Constitution. The founding finaglers created the Supreme Court as a critical, appointed for life, check on the popular will. And in two landmark decisions that took place in the lifetime of everybody in this room, I think. Everybody, I'm looking around. In the Buckley-Valeo decision, 1976, and the Citizens United decision of 2010, the High Court has ruled that private campaign contributions are free speech and that there are no constitutional limits that can be set on how much the rich and the powerful can invest in the giant organized bribery project that is U.S. campaign finance. Don't like it. Too bad. Simon, I mean the Supreme Court and the Constitution, says. Want to form a politically relevant, more genuinely progressive and egalitarian third party beyond the radically regressive and reactionary Republicans and the dismal dollar-drenched Democrats? Hope the Founders' Holy Charter is not on your side. It encourages winner-take-all, first-past-the-post elections tied to specific geographical districts. There's no provision in it for proportional representation to accommodate and create room for third or fourth parties that are never ready at the first election that they roll out their agendas to compete and win pluralities in American elections. You don't like it. Neither do I, neither do most Americans. Most Americans forever have told pollsters that the two big money major parties do not adequately represent the actual spectrum of political opinion in this country. And again, so what? Who cares? Too bad. Simon says, sit down and shut up. So what is to be done? Everything. Everything is still to be done. You don't have to have a decent constitution in place to engage in class struggle and the fight for the common good. The Bolsheviks didn't need a good constitution. There wasn't any constitution at all to make the Russian Revolution in 1917. Electoral politics, constitutional interventions and congressional investigations and Mueller reports are not the only or even the leading politics that matter or ought to matter most to a real functioning left. Take to the streets, occupy workplaces, idle capital, besiege corporate headquarters, protest corporate media, sabotage pipelines, monkey wrench ecocide, defend immigrants, provide sanctuary, form grassroots movements, learn how to build barricades, put on a yellow vest, become a gilet jaune, stop traffic, transcend sectarianism, form a movement culture that makes movements fun again, engage in civil disobedience, join the Extinction Rebellion, get real about the state of the world, hold workshops on what capitalism and industrialism are doing to livable ecology, form community permacultural gardens, resist the racist police. People are doing this. None of this stops being essential because the nation is absurdly beholden to an absurd parchment from the time when the nation was ruled by slave owners and merchant capitalists wearing powdered wigs.
And tights.
And tights, too. That said, we ought, like the Gilets Jaunes in France, to be calling for a new national government and a new national charter. Around the planet, national constitutions actually do not generally last all that long. As Zachary Elkins, Thomas Ginsburg, and James Melton note in their book, The Endurance of National Constitutions, it sounds like the title of their book actually ought to be The Non-Endurance of National Constitutions, quote, "The mean lifespan of constitutions across the world since 1789, French Revolution, is 17 years. Since World War I, the average lifespan of a constitution, they say, is 12 years. And I'm not saying we should be rewriting constitutions every 2 months either. I mean, that can get dysfunctional as well. But the U.S. is just ridiculously different. It's just off the charts the other way. It's absurdly venerated, purposefully democracy-disabling constitution has remained in place with occasional amendments for 230-plus years. We've bowed down and prayed to the fetishized, explicitly, openly anti-democratic U.S. Constitution for way too long. We deserve something better. We ought to write. We deserve something much better, to be drafted by people's representatives elected to a constituent assembly, empowered to write a new national charter that would be dedicated to the introduction and the preservation of our holy founder's ultimate nightmare, popular sovereignty." And, you know, perhaps in Q&A we can talk about some of what might be included in such a new national charter. Curiously enough, that has actually emerged in the Gilets Jaunes movement. There's an explicit call for a Sixth Republic in France and for a rejection of the fetish of so-called bourgeois representationalism and a call for direct democracy. Imagine that. And isn't it amazing how monumentally invisible the French protests have been in American media? And in fact, when they were peaking in December and November, I swear, this doesn't surprise me actually, I saw more footage from France. This is incredible footage. This is a country that shares a lot of Western civilizational history in the United States. It has a seat on the United Nations Security Council. This is a big deal nation, France. They're a nuclear power, both in terms of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, undergoing a prolonged mass, damn near proto-revolutionary movement in the streets for week after week after week. And it was barely covered on cable news, on CNN and MSNBC. And I saw more of it on Fox, because Fox kind of liked it, because they hate Macron, because they paint him out as some sort of leftist, which is, of course, completely absurd. He's a neoliberal in the mode of the Clintons and the Obamas. And it was sparked by a fuel tax. And the Trumpies loved that, because then they wanted to frame the Gilets Jaunes as really being against the environmental agenda, which was bullshit, because, in fact, what the Gilets Jaunes, many of them are environmentalists, what they were objecting to was the regressive nature of the fuel tax was disproportionately imposed on these working class people who have to commute to work at ever increasing distances from French cities because of gentrification in France. And also it was a tax that had come in the wake of the repeal of the famous social wealth tax in France too. In other words, they were saying, why should we have to disproportionately pay for efforts to stem climate change? They weren't, you know, and it turns out they're not anti-climate. They're not against healing the planet and all that. But in any event, not even on the radar screen of our media. I'm trying to remember at the time Gilets Jaunes was going on, what was obsessing national media at the time. Oh, there was the shutdown stuff. Yeah, we were all about the shutdown stuff. And of course, we've been obsessed about Russia. You would think there's just nothing but Russia's alleged oligarchic overthrow of our purported democracy for just about the last 2 years, right? You know, I did a paper on Truth Dig, or I think it was Counterpunch somewhere. It's like, who will save our democracy from the oligarchs? The American oligarchs. the American oligarchy. And anyway, I thought I'd throw all that in there. You know, I want to interject a little bit. There's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that it's grim. The one thing I like about this Extinction Rebellion group, which has come up, is that they reject, and they do this in an in kind of a spiritual Buddhist existential kind of way, they reject the false dichotomies of hope and fear, this future orientation. We always have to stay hopey, changey, and happy. No, The old left-wing slogan, don't mourn, organize, is bullshit. I don't want to be organized by anybody that doesn't know how to mourn. Properly mourn the situation we're in. Deal with it. And take your future and then get real about where we really are. That's where actual action that might matter begins. And the ER slogan is hope dies, action begins. And I actually like that. Because we live in the present moment, and hope and fear, but both take us out of it. The earth is our witness. The real world that we're living in, where livable ecology is now seriously in danger. And human extinction is something we can actually talk about by 2100. Deal with that and then get serious and operate from there, not from some future type of thing. I had to say that. Well, okay, so Bob, I've been taking some notes. Let me see if I can address some of that. There's more to that than one might think. You know, this notion that that they would prefer a fascist in power, a creeping fascist. You know, it's funny, you know, with Trump now, in the probably this last few months, we're starting to see a crossover from just fascist, you know, Jason Stanley's fascist political rhetoric to some actual fascist conduct with the declaration of a national emergency. And this biker stuff about that the bikers and the troops and the police are on my side, and if you push them too far, things could get real ugly. What is that? What is he saying? He's saying that if the Electoral College doesn't go my way, I'm going to declare it illegitimate, and I've got armed force behind me to try. I don't know whether he could pull that off or not. And Michael Cohen warned about this in his testimony to Congress. This guy will not leave office peacefully. So you know, some of that stuff's for real. I mean, it's not just silly. It's not funny anymore. You know, it never was. But you know, this is not a laughing matter. And I did a piece on Counterpunch a couple weeks ago, I think it was, that was motivated by the fact that I'd seen this net worth $200 million advertising executive, Donnie Deutsch. He was on MSNBC, which all of us on the left now call MSDNC. And he was on that. And he actually went on record, and then Joe Scarborough, who I call, I have a very bad habit I share with Trump of making up nicknames. I call him Moaning Joe Scarecrow. So Morning Joe Scarbo corrected him on it, made him backtrack a little bit. But he said, it would be such a disaster if we had a socialist presidential candidate. I couldn't tell if it was president or president candidate at the head of the Democrats, that I would vote for Donald Trump before I'd vote for the Democrat in that case. And then Moaning Joe Scarecrow made him step back from that a little bit. But he said it flat out. And this is a regular commentator on MSNBC. And so, I mean, it's not just something we say. I think it's kind of true. And, you know, I hear a lot about how Sanders, in the one-on-one polls in 2016, you know, Sanders, around the primary season, was totally outperforming Hillary vis-a-vis Trump. He was coming out way ahead. The thing about saying, though, that Sanders would have won, it's tricky about that, is the money would have shifted. But between the primaries and the general election, you would have seen a lot of that big corporate money that Hillary was getting going over to Trump. The other problem with that is that Sanders might have been able to defeat Trump, but it's questionable whether he could have really done anything. He could have done anything because there would have been a capital strike and complete total obstructionism. It could have been a disaster from the perspective of the left, because then it would all be blamed. Kind of like, you know, Venezuela is all like proof that socialism doesn't work. Well, that would have happened with Sanders, even though actually Venezuela is being crippled by external economic sanctions and U.S. intervention, blah, blah, blah. So I'm digressing there. But that's my point, is agreeing with that first point you got. They really would prefer to have a fascist in there than having even a mildly progressive social democrat. Bernie's not a socialist. He calls himself one. He's a neo-New Dealer. Now, I actually do prefer to have the Democrats in office, but for a different reason than the usual lesser evil argument. You know, you're talking about young people, and they don't know stuff that we know. They have to go through that experience of seeing Democrats in the White House and finding out that everything still sucks when they're in there. I noticed that whenever Republicans are in the White House, it just feeds this narrative that everything that's wrong with the country is it that the wrong party is in the White House? And then it just feeds the narrative that the whole solution is a big get-out-the-vote program to get a Democrat in. And it just kills social movements. It's actually better, I think, for social movements. People debate about this. It's tricky. On domestic side, it's better to have a Democrat in there. On the other hand, a Democrat in the White House seems to just destroy anti-war movements, which is so it's problematic. But having a Democrat in there is very instructive. That's how the New Left happened to some extent. You know, they went from the gray-flanneled Eisenhower era to Technicolor, charismatic Kennedy, and then he got shot and there was LBJ, you know, and young folks learned that they're still a corporate imperialist racist state. And the new left was formed. Yeah. So, and Obama was instructive in that regard to no small extent. Occupy happened because of that. Black Lives Matter happened because of that. So I would prefer that a Democrat win in 2020. I mean, the other reason I prefer that is I do think actually Trump is a different beast. This is something else. This is not just the usual Republican Party. He is a living, breathing sort of fascist threat. And my friend Terry Thomas, who's this genius guy I know that I went to graduate school with and who lives surrounded by Trump people in rural Illinois, says a lot of you folks on the coasts and in the cities don't know how bad it is. They're coming after you. And he gets a second term. And we might be thinking about some real full-on fascism there. I think that's going on. Kamala. You know what I think of? You know, I think you might be right on that. Because I was starting to think that it was going to be Biden.
She's Obama 2.0. She really is.
Well, there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of that with Beto, too. But he doesn't have the serious policy record. Yeah. And I was thinking that it would be Biden just because of the name recognition and the nostalgia for the Obama era and the association of him with it. And yes, he's too old and decrepit and says crazy stuff, but then you'd bring in sexy young social media Beto to be the youth ballast and maybe a sense of one term for Biden and Beto. But it seems like he's too inept. You know, he's just too, you know, out of it. And his record really is right wing. How's he going to get millennials to vote for him when you can go back in his record and show that he was a leading agent in the Senate for preventing efforts to roll back college student debt? So Harris might be better situated. And I'll say something else about Harris. Kamala Harris, maybe Cory Booker, but above all Kamala Harris, to me, is a nuclear weapon aimed at Bernie Sanders' ability to overcome one of his great liabilities in 2015-16, which was the black vote. And he did. He had a lot of screw-ups with the black vote, and he's trying to be better this time. The black vote is kind of a mysterious thing that is often misunderstood. Sanders, the black vote, in my experience, or from my analysis, is very sort of practical. The black people in America have a realistic sense of the Republican Party now as kind of like the KKK, and they want it to be defeated. Because they have a sin. You know, if anyone's actually living in a fascist state right now in America, it's black people with the mass incarceration rate. And Jason Stanley said this, by the way, at Loyola yesterday. He said, you know, it's hyperbole to say we're living in a fascist state right now. There's a president who uses fascist rhetoric, but come on, you don't live in a fascist state. But then he said, except for a lot of the immigrant population and a fair amount of the black population. The black population wants that white nationalist party out, and its support for Hillary, insofar as it supported Hillary, you know, with significantly reduced enthusiasm in 2016, was just about the sense. They bought the sense. It made sense to them that she was the one that would defeat Trump and that Sanders was less likely to be able to defeat Trump. And the anomaly being that blacks have been the leftmost section of the U.S. electorate forever. They're the socialists. They're the most social democratic people there, not just on race issues, but on class issues and on everything. And they're the most anti-imperialist. They're the leftmost section of the electorate. So you'd think, well, they should have went with Sanders. But no. They wanted to. So I was thinking and hoping that this time around, maybe Sanders would get that pragmatism. Hillary's gone. The Clinton machine is gone. And Sanders could sort of pose as the heir apparent, as the Democratic nominee. I mean, he almost pulled it off in 2016 with no corporate money at all, none. That's the most remarkable thing about Sanders, I'll praise him for. And that he'd sweep in and he'd get the black vote, and that's the fear that the corporate neoliberals have, and Kamala is about preventing. See, he could win Iowa, and then he's got the regional on his side for New Hampshire. That'd be too straight. Then you go to South Carolina, and imagine that Sanders had finally connected with the black voters. with their pragmatic calculations merging up with their social democratic calculation, that'd be three straight. Except they've moved up California sooner now, too, which works there. You see, that works to her advantage, too. That works for Kamala, that they've moved her up sooner. So she destroys Tim with the black vote, and okay. And then the last thing about the youth, maybe I already hit it. That's one reason we need Democrats in. They need to go through that experience of a President Kamala or a President Beto, and we still have three people owning half the wealth in the country, and we're still destroying livable ecology. Some little kids found that out in Dianne Feinstein's office earlier this year. Did you catch that? The little Sunrise kids who said, you know, literally like grade schoolers, you know, Mrs. Feinstein, we'd like to live to 85 too, like you. And, you know, we're in the Sunrise Movement, and we'd like, you know, and Dianne Feinstein, like the corporate neoliberal, she has a net worth, her and her husband, $94 million. Dianne Feinstein, bicoastal, progressive neoliberal, wicked witch of the neoliberal West, was like, no, I know what the hell I'm doing, you little punks, and I get the F out of my office. Die, little kiddies, die. I was like, great. That's what we need, yes, sir.
Now, so the lack of democracy and it boiling down to just a couple states, I agree with you, but it's even more constrained than that. It's regions of states from northeastern Pennsylvania. I'm going to campaign in Philadelphia, but they're in and out of northeastern. You ever seen a Trump rally in northeastern Pennsylvania? Chilling. And not going to win northeastern Pennsylvania. And your friend Terry Thomas,
yeah.
He's
in Illinois surrounded by Trumpsters So he's in a blue state, but he's in a red region.
And very much
see, that's a good point, right?
Two points about this is that region, I'm from Wilkes-Barre, voted twice, first overwhelmingly for Obama,
right.
Second with a substantial margin, swung big time to Trump. The message of Bernie, if it could be spoken, and Bernie for all his work, I'm no Bernie bandwagon, flagwave, that could maybe catch hold. You run Kamala Harris in there, forget about it.
You
know, it's just not going to happen. And your friend Terry Thomas, I grew up there, I know these people. Good people in yeah. some ways. Yeah. But very susceptible to this demagoguery. The Republicans have always been better at cultural politics than the Democrats.
You know that Mike Davis has written about some of this in very interesting. They talk about a genius, right? And you know this. And there was this Haymarket Press book that came out. I'm blanking on the title of it last year. Where all these really smart left intellectuals were reflecting on why Hillary lost and Trump won, and overall the notion that the white working class voted in Trump. Mm-hmm. Turns out to not so much be the case. It's really the traditional Republican base. And the reason people think it was all the working class is because we over-identify whether you have a college degree or not with what class you're in. In fact, there's a lot of petty bourgeois and actually fairly well-off people without college degrees that live in places like this. They're dentists. They probably have college degrees, don't they? Car salesmen, building contractors, people like that. They're doing all right. But now Davis, in this book, whose title I forgot, I forget the title. He's got some interesting data, though, that there are some real blue-collar types of places, particularly where there were plant closings, where you really did get the white working class, industrial worker, and then all the collateral people that are around where there's industry, too. Because when industry goes down, all kinds of collateral sectors go down. And I'm thinking that the district you're talking about is one of those, where you really did have the blue-collar Democratic voters that voted for Trump in 2016, they're just devastated by deindustrialization, and they went over to him.
5 million black voters stayed home.
Well, no, but the main thing that elects Trump is the demobilization of the electorate. But that's such a good point, and I'd forgotten about that, the demobilization within the states, too. Why even bother with Philadelphia?
Well, the danger I also see is the...
Well, you see, I'm so glad I've spent a fair amount of time. I've spent time in Iowa, and though I've been in bright blue Iowa City, which that's the someone ought to do a book about these, you know, like Lincoln, Nebraska, and Iowa City, or Columbia, Missouri, or, you know, where you've got these bright blue cosmopolitan campus towns that have a lot of people with Ivy League degrees in them. From all you got to do is go 5 minutes outside town. You're in red state America just like that. You see these guys driving through Iowa City. And it's not so much motorcycles, it's pickup trucks. And they've got shotguns on the back of them, and they're looking at this multicultural campus town scene and all the Chinese students. And there's some really wealthy Chinese students at the University of Iowa. And you can just see they're seething. They're looking at this whole scene there. These guys are ready to shoot at other than pheasant and deer. And they would love an opportunity for all hell to break loose. But I'm so glad you mentioned the rallies, too. Have you been to a Trump rally? Oh, you've been to them? Well, then you're a first-person primary source observer. My son went to one in Tennessee, and I've heard from people, and I've seen, and now that you can watch them on Fox News, some of the live ones. I watched El Paso one. Those freaking things are Weimar Germany fascist rallies. And people who don't think fascism is going on have got to go on and sit around through one of those things. Yes, sir. Thank you so much for that reflection.
Thank you for everything you do.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm in a blue bubble now called Chicago. So you know what? Trump did win some precincts here. Can you guess which ones? Where cops live? Yeah. Mount Greenwood. So there's the southwest and the northwest sides. And the thing is, when the Bubbas come into the cities, the thing that scares the shit out of me, we're bright blue and we're inoculated. They're the white cops on their side. Trump's been cultivating the cops who live in Staten Island, you know. And they live out in Queens, and the cops who live in Mount Greenwood, and I'm sure Philly's got them.
Remember Giuliani's rally in New York City with...
Yeah. No, it's okay. Yeah. The Rizzo voters in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. You know, back in the day. There's a new book out, by the way, about the white working class in Rizzo by some guy. Yes. I forget his name. That looked really interesting to me. He was on C-SPAN just yesterday. Yeah. Looks real interesting. Yeah.
And I couldn't agree with you more that hope is...
Feel the hopelessness.
Well, they say you have to feel the hope, and I say, well, you must be 8 years old if you have to feel it in order to do it. I mean, obviously, you never grew up.
Well, what do they want to happen to the hope?
I can't answer that. Their attitude is that they say that I should be spreading faith in the future, and therefore...
Oh. Do they use the word catastrophism?
They don't quite get there, but that's
okay. That's a thing that gets thrown around. Where I get accused of being a catastrophist, here's the Earth Science diagnosis. This is what it is. I mean,
you talk to just about anybody, yeah. And at that point, it's up to the military whether we ever get our democracy.
I think that's kind of what Buzz Windrip did in the Sinclair Lewis novel. It Can't Happen Here.
Yeah, well, it can't.
Which
happen.
Is a chilling it's read been, these days.
Every,
yeah.
Every president has made it easier.
Yeah.
When presidents declare the entire world a battle zone, it's not hard to call Capitol Hill a battle zone. I'm not big on hope.
Let me defend a little bit in an ironic dialectical kind of way, since Bob likes the word dialectical. The hope mongers, though, there was, go look up and see if you can find a brilliant essay that, you know, that Brooklyn-based Left Business Observer guy, Doug Henwood, wrote. Yeah. In, I think it was March 2008, and it was all about Obama. And he, like me and Glenn Ford and a bunch of us on the left, particularly people from Chicago who knew the Obama phenomena as a Chicago and Illinois phenomena before the national one, we knew what he was going to be all about all along. And Henwood, very sharp, very cynical, brilliant guy, you know, knew what Obama was going to be in advance. And he did an article called Would You Like Some Change With That? But he said there is hope in Obama. And he said the hope is... when it gets crashed, when it hits the wall, when he's excited all these young people and got them all thinking, and he made the New Left analogy with JFK. You know, all the youth, the young people, the Ivy League charisma, the telegenicism of JFK, you know, hitting that wall of corporate and imperialist crap, you know, and it's like the wake-up to the youth of that. And I think some of that happened to some extent. I think it took a while with... you know, with Obama, but I think some of that happened. I think that's how Occupy happened. And you know, Occupy was a big deal that then screwed up. They like went right up to the edge of saying we should nationalize the financial institutions, and then it's like, nah, we don't actually have policy demands. Or, I mean, could they have at least said financial transaction tax? I think that might have resonated with a lot of us, but anyway. But so I'm saying maybe, yeah, I would say play with the hope thing dialectically and let it hit the wall.
Obama was a hypnotizer early on. He said,
a bamboozler.
Of saying things that people decided they wanted to hear whether they listened properly or not, whether they knew what he was about or not.
You know, but you know, there was a class of Obama supporters, and I knew them. I ran into some of them in Iowa City. That in some ways, they were the worst. I would give the left critique of Obama. He's really a, you know, the Adolf Reed critique. He's really a vacuous to repressive neoliberal. And they go, yeah, you're right. And they liked it, you know? And he's just using identity politics, and he's just using race, and he's pretending to be progressive. And there were people with PhDs and political scientists and law professors, because my son, I wanted to be involved in the because I'd never been in a state that had a presidential election, and I wanted to know what the Iowa caucus thing was. I kind of went undercover in it. My son got a job after he was done with Grinnell for Edwards, and Edwards was kind of an interesting phenomenon. I told the Sanders people when they came through Iowa City in 2014, I said, don't just look at the Obama thing. You got to go take a look at those rallies that Edwards used to have with the Two Americas thing, you know, the rich and the poor, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I got involved in some of it, and I let him get me out knocking on doors, and I'd have these bizarre conversations with really snotty sort of academics who got the left critique of Obama, and it made them like him even more. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
It does make sense. Yeah. I know.
Well, you know what the thing was? They were so excited to have an opportunity to pat themselves on the back. They're ready to vote for a black candidate. And you go, oh, well, so you care about race. Did you know that Iowa has the highest racial disparity in its incarceration rates in the country? And I go, no, you don't say. You know? And then some black guy got shot the next year in 09 by a cop. Just a hideous, horrible thing. Right downtown area. John Bior Deng. I didn't give a shit about it. There was like a civil rights movement for like an afternoon, and then it died. I mean, you know, race beneath the color of faces in high places, like how our society structures. Didn't matter to him. We're going far afield, but that's okay.
I have a bunch of friends that get together with the Iraqi refugees.
I worked with a guy that I know exactly what you're talking about, an Iraqi guy a couple years ago.
So
yeah.
I tell them some of the things you've mentioned and some of the coming problems we're going to have, and they say, well, what should we do about it?
Yeah.
And I tell them, hold on to your Iraqi passports. Renew your Iraqi passports for your kids. Because no matter how, you know, you can't imagine it now, but it might get so bad here that you might want to go back to Iraq and send your kids back.
Well, this guy that my buddy of mine, Terry Thomas, says that, and he said he's actually looking into Denmark, which is it's very tough to immigrate to Denmark, apparently. My old teaching assistant when I taught at Northern Illinois University was a young guy who lives in Norway now. He got out, you know. So, I mean, Terry's kind of prone to really dire kinds of projections about where we might be heading. But the thing is, like you, he has direct proximity to people. A lot of my left friends, seriously armed. Absolutely. And they're hooked in with a...
They walk around with guns. Looking for.
And they have, and they're part of a cyber culture that's deeply fascistic and right wing. And I think this is an issue that I've had sometimes with a lot of my left cohorts, because most of the people that I'm in internet communities with live in places like New York or Berkeley, right? Or Berkeley, yeah, like parks, you know. And they've got hipster Bernie Bros walking around on every street corner and jazz and, you know, the whole multicultural world of the city. I said, and a lot of them sort of poo-poo the threat of fascism. And I said, if you lived in the hinterland, you might take this threat more seriously.
You can't agree with inequality. It's just, I mean, the debt that, well...
You mean of those people,
yes.
and what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can never go wrong making dire predictions, because they have a habit of coming true.
But how insulted these people! The thing is, though, it's I watch a lot of I'll watch a fair amount of corporate media content, and not just the news. You know, I actually think consent. You know, I said this to Noam Chomsky once. I said, if you really want to see how consent is manufactured, forget just the New York Times and the Washington Post. You got to watch, or the news. You got to watch the sitcoms and the Law and Order shows and the movies. And you watch that. So if you look at the Hollywood culture, and I'll sort of put myself in the shoes of white Heartland Wilkes-Barre America and look even at the commercials and the sort of arrogant bicoastal multiculturalism of the dominant culture. And I just see these guys sitting there seething. You know what I'm saying? Just seething about this culture. Just watch the award ceremonies, you know, the academies and the stuff, and you know they're just loading. They just made another order. They just made another ammo order. We're going to take care of these boys, people, by God. Yeah.
Ad where the two couples are buying the $75,000 pickup trucks, and it's the surprise. You may have seen it for a Ford for Dodge pickup truck. It's Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not one $75,000 pickup truck in the car. It's two.
That's
know?
Right. And she likes the color.
And she likes
the other color.
Right? So I have a lot of friends from high school.
Right.
You know,
no.
On Facebook, that ad came up. It was people were enraged. Who the hell? Heck, who are these people that can buy? You know.
Think about
like
it, because it's a pickup truck too, and these guys drive pickup trucks. Yeah. And these people, what is a pickup truck? I don't even know. What does a pickup truck cost nowadays?
Those high end ones, $75,000.
So this is like a cherished object in a fair upon America, and these rich folks, wherever the hell they live on one of the two coasts, just buy them up like that. that is such a great. That's all right. We're done. That is such a great analogy. I hadn't thought of that. And the pickup truck, it's just absolutely perfect. Yeah, we're on the same wavelength here.
On that, on my friend's Facebook.
They went nuts with that one in particular.
That one in particular.
That one in particular. Yeah. Just think of all the. Anyway, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, this is not my question. The other side of the theme of exposing the Democratic Party, for example, under Obama, is the cynicism and despair.
The what?
Cynicism, despair, and
engagement. Yeah.
That's the other side.
Yeah, that's true.
And which I see personally. But my question is, talking about, and maybe this is a chicken and egg question, can you have democracy in an oligarchy? And the question, and I'll tell you why I asked that question. My wife and I purposefully were in Scotland during the referendum on independence.
Oh.
We wanted to see what was going on. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
My wife's,
sure.
Anyway, so the bottom line was, everywhere we went, all we saw was yes, yes, yes. Signs in the windows, everywhere, all throughout the country.
Right.
And then, of course, they voted it down. What we didn't see, because we weren't watching television, was all of the information, all the propaganda saying if Scotland becomes its own country, it won't be able to join the EU. It wouldn't be allowed to use the euro. You know, and essentially would destroy their economy. Of course, now these people are totally pissed that Britain's leaving the EU.
Right.
But
right.
So the question is, you know, in a situation with democracy, with the concentration of corporate media, the concentration of wealth, and the ability to scare people into voting against their own self-interest.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a chicken and egg question, perhaps, but, you know, how do you get one?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think you can have them at the same time. And Aristotle said you couldn't have them at the same time. He said one of them would have to give. You'd have to have either. You have to choose. Thomas Jefferson said something similar to that. And there was the famous quote from Louis Brandeis, and I found out more and more, even though they put it on the sidebar of the Brandeis University. You know the Brandeis quote, the American people must choose? He's supposed to have said it in 1941, and no one can actually run down the actual quote. So you have to tell the Brandeis University this. But it's not unlike something that Louis Brandeis would have said, which was the American people must choose. You can have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy, but you can't have both. Pretty much for the reasons that you said. You know, now, what I would elaborate upon that in saying that if Louis Brandeis actually said that or wrote that, he was denouncing capitalism as anti-democratic, because Thomas Piketty showed in his book that Marx was right and that capital, and that Webster's, my gigantic version of the collegiate Webster's dictionary definition is correct. It has in its definition of capitalism that it has an inherent tendency towards an increase in concentration of wealth. So then you're with Ellen Mikeson's Wood, the recently deceased Canadian York University Marxist who wrote a book called Democracy Against Capitalism. They just are incompatible with one. So I don't think you can, but you can certainly fight and struggle and try to have some countervailing power from the bottom up. which we had to some extent in the 20th century, largely through unions. It was the main collective bargaining power. My main candidate for the most underestimated factor that never gets mentioned behind the rightward drift of American politics is the fact that we had a union density rate of like 40% when I was a little kid, and I think it's under 10% now. It's and the private sector is down to 6%. So even just by the rules of the game of capitalist politics, you just don't have that. It is absolutely extraordinary how close Sanders came to winning the Democratic nomination in 2016. With no business. They've crunched the numbers on this. He didn't have a single corporate business donation. That just doesn't happen. So something's going on out there. 57% of registered Democrats call themselves socialists now. If you dug down into that poll and looked at millennial Democrats, I'm giving to you, it's two-thirds. How the heck did that happen? And that's James Madison's nightmare. That's a whole topic in and of itself. I have ideas on that, but we could be here forever. I think capitalism, as experienced by young people, which is actually they're the first generations that they're going to be worse off than their parents' generation, and it percolates down to middle class kids now, thanks to the student debt thing.
You're making my point entirely.
This
is basically where I was coming from, and I want to go back to again something you just said that I think is relevant to this overall discussion. It's about Sanders. We don't really know if he might have actually won. Whatever happened with all those California votes? These questions.
I give him even money to have won.
He also did not have, like you said, correctly so.
He might have.
There was no corporate money whatsoever, provided him.
None.
This gets back to my argument, my thesis here, why I think that, what's going to happen, because this is what we're talking about. This is a very spirited discussion here today. I like this a lot.
Well, we've got a cadre here.
Well, yeah, but we're all over the block with this. But yet, we're bringing up a lot of really relevant, important things. There's a lot of contradictions in all of this too. It's very evident. But I wanted to say this. This gets back to I think what the crucial issue is in all of this, and it's going to come back down to what the money. Because as you said, and I think correctly so, the youth is pretty much lost. One more misstep by the Democrats, I think it's going to be real trouble for that party going forward in a historic sense. Because a lot of people were awoken by what happened with Barack Obama, right? That was a lesson for many, many liberals. But the point being in all this is they got one more chance. And it's probably going to wind up, like I say, depending on how this plays out, and I don't know, maybe I'm all wet, maybe I'm all wrong about, my thesis being that look out for, Kamala Harris, but I think she's their person going forward. The money's going to be there. She's saying all the things they want you to hear. The question is, will the people buy it? I don't buy it. You don't buy it. This room doesn't buy it, but we have to see.
There is a thing called Movement for a People's Party right now that's started up, and it's headed by these young people who are former Bernie staffers. You can look them up online. And they're really interesting. They don't have any. They've broken from the kind of, you can sheepdog people with Bernie Sanders into the electoral system. You can also sheepdog people into the party's electoral politics with third-party politics. And at a certain point, I just got tired of third party politics because I didn't want to hear about them anymore unless you're also talking about fundamental constitutional change. I would include in my draft for a new charter, my new Gilles Jean's, second American Republic, you would write into it no private money in public elections and full proportional representation. It would be. Well, there you go. And then, but you would write into, you'd have to overhaul so many things, but you'd have to make it so 20% of the vote means you get 20% of the representative in that. And I don't know. I better get to this gentleman before I say any more.
A few areas of question I like to
see. That's interesting. You mentioned the state level, and I'm not an expert about state level constitutional conventions and all that, but I know there's some law professors who talk about what would the mechanism for calling a national constitutional convention. In some states, I think there's a referendum process You can actually, I think you can call a constitutional convention by referendum. But you say it's every 20 years in Illinois?
20 years there's a vote.
And then there's probably a fight about this absurdity. We're in so much trouble in the state of Illinois fiscally because we are constitutionally prohibited from having a progressive income tax, which is just insane. So I take it that's one of the... I remember when I was at the Urban League, the CEO there was always talking about that, you know, and... What do they do? Then you elect delegates to the Constitutional Convention? In other words, we could look at the states for a model. I'm thinking, I'm at a very research level right now at this, so you sound like you might know more about it than I do. But it sounds like we should research what's going on at the state level to think about what we can do at the federal level. You know, I'm thinking that I'm more about a Constitutional Convention in the wake of a big social movement for radical change, because a Constitutional Convention in and of itself, under the existing balance of class forces in this country, there's a bunch of people on the right and arch-libertarians who are frothing to have a Constitutional Convention. Your guys in Wilkes-Barre...
They need 35 state legislatures, and they got 33 to call.
But I mean, there's a bunch of the Koch brothers want a constitutional convention. The right wing would like to get rid of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and reestablish slavery in the United States of America. Yeah, and set up concentration camps for liberals and left intellectuals. You know, I mean, I'm not. You know, I thought I was going to say I was kidding there, and I realized maybe I'm not completely kidding. Yeah, but there's the model there. Listen, on Chicago. I was sure that money alone, I watched the commercials. I was amazed. I mean, the Daily's commercials, you know, were pathetically Orwellian. I mean, here's this globalist who was Clinton's point man for NAFTA, right? And then who has made millions in global finance saying that he was the guy from the neighborhoods. You know, the loop is profiteering at the expense of the neighborhoods. Well, you know, I mean... You know, his old man still, the original Daily lived forever in a little bungalow in Bridgeport, you know, so there is this kind of Daily imagery. But the second Daily was a total corporatist, okay? And he lost. You know, I think that's between Daily 2 and Rambo, they delegitimized. You know, these assholes who sold the underground parking garages to international global financial consortiums and the parking meters and the Skyway, you know, and I don't know if you've seen this thing on WBEZ about what's happened in the city of Chicago. It's fascinating. The color-coded maps, the contrast of Chicago 1970 and Chicago 2017 and the dark color blue for very rich census tracts and then... a bright red for deeply poor census tracts, and then a kind of tan shading for middle-income census tracts. 1970 has got a little bit of the bright blue for the rich around the Gold Coast, and a couple other little outposts of bright blue. That's a real rich. And it's got the hardcore black ghetto poverty on the south and the west side, which is the bright red, which is the real extreme poverty. And then most of the city is this kind of tannish, reddish type of middle-income. You know, and not rich. I mean, but a lot of them were even working class people that had union wages in 1970. And then the 2013 map, those people have, the middle income has just disappeared. And the bright blue has eaten up a whole bunch of the north side, and it's got a little bit of part of the south loop now. And then the bright red of the really poor is just drastically expanded. There's no middle income. The middle class is just gone. And those neighborhoods, there are five neighborhoods that may elect self-declared socialists as neighborhoods. Wards. There's two that are already in, and there's three more. And I think each one of them is a Latino ward, too, which is interesting. Does that include this one? Which I don't, you know, I'm curious about the relationship between the Latino ethnic identity of the wards that are going DSA. Is that about an ethnic culture that's less freaked out by socialism? Is it about gentrification and inequality in those wards or some combination of them? I mean, it sounds you guys know more about Chicago politics than I do, actually. So something's going on, and it's pretty cool. I'm not real excited about Lori Lightfoot because I don't think her record on the police protest stuff, the police, it sounds like she let some tops off, and she sounds like she was a sort of corporate neoliberal hack in the original Daily administration. But she's outside the machine. Yes, sir.
Last question.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, can you speak to the way the accusation or anti-communism is being inserted into the so-called dialogue when people are starting to talk about so-called progressive or socialist issues in this time?
Well, it's all over the media now. It's all over the media politics culture. And all you got to do is turn on CNN and MSDNC, and it's the first word out of these commentators' mouths. And it's not just from the right. You know, it's weird. We have a new type of McCarthyism now. We have a new McCarthyism. Classic McCarthyism was about the Cold War era. Now the Soviet threat and the socialist threat have been split apart from one another, you know? And the Democrats are running... We're running with this whole Russia line, and it gets called neo-McCarthyism, but it is and it isn't. It is that on the foreign policy level, it is because the enemy is Russia. The problem is that Russia, some of my Trump and left fans don't seem to understand this. I mean, some of my online Trump, what I call Trump and left friends, not fans, don't seem to even get it that they dismantled socialism in the Soviet Union, and they tore down the Berlin Wall, and it's now kind of a fascist right-wing oligarchy right now, that no one wants to be like friends, capitalists, for God's sake. So, but Russia did it, but it's not socialist anymore. And then the great moment in the State of the Union address where Trump actually said, let us all now pledge that the United States will never be a socialist country. I never thought I'd hear something like that in the State of the Union address. And most of the Democrats, except Sanders, stood up and applauded. Even Pelosi was back there. I don't know. I don't know how these guys, these Wilkes-Barre guys and these Iowa guys, respond to socialism. That's an interesting thought. Now he was suggesting that Sanders would have won some of these guys, and I think he might have. I think they're split. I don't think you can homogenize all of them. The thing about this is really there's this interesting line in Jason Stanley's book about fascism, about how fascists get to benefit from seeming authentic, because the corporate domination of the liberal politics exposes the liberal politicians like Obama and Hillary as so deeply inauthentic. And they mouth all this politically correct kind of multicultural stuff, and it all comes off as just gibberish in defense of a globalist corporate state. And Trump just walks into that like fascists do, like Bolsonaro in Brazil, like the guy in charge of Hungary, like the guy in charge of Poland. They just walk in with this plain talking Archie Bunker type of, you know, f*** 'em kind of attitude. I'm not going to worry about what I say anymore. And it looks authentic. Sanders had a little bit of that just barrel-chested, you know, truck driver from Brooklyn kind of thing, getting up there and being pissed off at the 1% and not sounding like someone from Yale or Harvard. Which, I mean, Hillary's Yale law. That's not even Harvard law. That's one step above, man. Rachel Maddow's got a PhD in political science from Oxford, for Christ's sake.
That's going to be it, Paul. We are way